Let's turn our attention to Genesis chapter 50 as God teaches us in the world of conservation. You will often hear of invasive species. Somehow I got signed up for a conservation magazine from the state of Missouri. Full glossy magazine shows up each week and or each month. And it is mostly about stuff that really does not interest me. I mean, I appreciate the color pictures of a neat tadpole or salamander, but I'm not a great outdoorsman. I enjoy fishing and stuff, but really don't do much of it. But if you do much fishing, you might know that there are certain fish or diseases that we don't want introduced to our state's waterways. I don't do much boating, but I have learned that those who do are supposed to inspect their boat and trailer when they move from one body of water to another so that they don't take snails or barnacles or larvae from some species in one area and transport it to another area. If you do much camping, you will see signs about not transporting firewood from one region to another, again, to eliminate any disruption to the local ecosystems. I don't know that many of you do international travel too often, but a few of you may have done so. And you may have seen the paperwork for declaring in any of your possessions any food, any plants or plant substances, any animal substances, because they don't want any seeds or bugs or anything leaving one country and becoming a problem in another. And if none of that makes any sense to you, perhaps you've at least tried to grow a green lawn only to have something invasive like crabgrass take over your yard. The danger is the corruption of something that is good by something that is bad. So the conservation department works to educate citizens on how to resist these invasive species that will take over. Well, today our text will educate us on how to resist the invasive corruption of an unforgiving spirit. The invasive corruption of an unforgiving spirit. Will invade and then contaminate the once spirit-filled life. In other words, you may be godly and living a spirit-filled life, but this invasive species, this idea of being unforgiving, of being annoyed and bothered and remembering your spouse's offense, something your parents did, something small, something great. The unforgiveness will contaminate the once spirit-filled life because it no longer is the spirit-filled life if there is the spirit of unforgiveness. We will study this in the weeks to come, but the Bible has much to say about forgiveness and the danger of unforgiveness. So much so that even when Jesus taught us to pray, he would say, if you don't forgive, you have no right to expect forgiveness from God. Frankly, you're probably not forgiven if you perpetually hang on to the offenses of others and refuse to forgive. This story in Genesis chapter 50, in the closing chapter of the account of this great man Joseph, gives us this grand theme of forgiving others. And it reminds us that we must resist every temptation to allow unforgiveness to take its place in our thinking. And it will be this week that you must resist. Because in the slightest way, somebody will do something that bothers you. And you will either have to forgive in the fullest sense, or maybe cover in love, because it doesn't even need to be addressed for restoration. You just need to get over it and know that you love that person enough that you're not going to be bothered. But in some way, small or great, forgiveness will be on the table this week. It's the source of road rage. You know, we can't let that go. That's not right. He should have merged earlier. He shouldn't have pulled in so close. Are you going to deal with it or not? Unforgiveness, if unchecked, will contaminate the once spirit-filled life. As we come to chapter 50 in Genesis, Joseph has buried his father back in the homeland. And now with the patriarch of the family gone, the brothers suddenly feel vulnerable. Without Jacob's authority, which Joseph would have highly esteemed, will Joseph now unleash his vengeance, his retribution? Well, of course, you know the story, and you know that's not the case. But let's examine this text to see how a spirit of unforgiveness could wreak havoc on friendships, on a marriage, on a family, and even on a church. And so there on your notes, you have seven descriptions of the corruption that comes through unforgiveness. Number one, unforgiveness indulges in the opportunity for angry revenge. The text that was read began in verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil we did to him." Make no mistake, there was a debt that was owed. Joseph had suffered greatly at the hands of his brothers. And frankly, there was probably no human power or authority that would have intervened to stop Joseph from exacting revenge. These brothers were rightly afraid. They knew what was owed to them in retribution or even justice, and they also knew that no one would stop Joseph. Pharaoh perhaps could, but in no way would. He would let Joseph do what Joseph wanted to do, as we've seen in the whole story of Joseph's rule. It is rare that we should need to dispute someone's claim of being wronged. When you're talking to people that have some offense, they've been hurt in some way, it's rare that we're disputing the offense, the wrongdoing. Oh, they might have exaggerated it a little bit, but it's rare that we dispute with someone the fact that what they just described was painful, that was wrong. It is far more common that we need to dispute their claim of being justified in their sinful response, their unforgiveness. Romans 12, verses 18 and 19. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord." Never avenge yourselves. That doesn't sit well with the person who has been offended. And it's clear. That's the truth. Somebody has done wrong to them, and they open up their Bible and read in Romans chapter 12, "Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to God." And so we'll hide behind our passion for justice. Well, this just can't stand. And so We avenge ourselves in the name of justice, in the name of what is right after all. I think we should know that God knows what is right, and in his rightness, he says, don't live to vindicate yourself every time somebody treats you wrongly. People in your life will sin. They will give you ample opportunities to begin a tally sheet of wrongdoings. They will hand you the opportunity to harbor bitterness and to stew about the injustice. Joseph models for us, by the grace of God, a heart that simply has no room for past offenses. God says that vengeance is not your business. Peace and forgiveness are your business. Vengeance and justice belong to him. I don't know that God trusts our estimation of justice. And so he calls us to this matter of peace, living peaceably with all as much as it depends on us. If there is any brokenness in relationships, let it not be because I had any contribution to it. I was working for peace. Unforgiveness indulges in this opportunity to finally make it right, to set the record straight. And some of you, justice is your thing. Like, you just need everything in its place, and if there's anything unresolved, it just doesn't work for you, but it needs to start working for you. Because God hasn't called you to set everything right. Half the time when you apologize, all you're doing is saying how right you are. And if you confront somebody, it's not to make peace. It's to show that you were right and justice has been served. And listen, the Bible speaks much of justice, but we'll study that another time. Because I'm weary of justice being the guise for unforgiveness and bitterness. Hear God's words simply. Never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. An unforgiving spirit will be eager for the guilty party to know the facts, to confront the truth. The unforgiving spirit will be glad when they finally suffer for what they've done to me or to someone else. When they have felt the pain that they caused, then I can rest easy. But that's not what we see in Genesis 50 in our story. Though that's what the brothers expected, that is not the way Joseph was living his life. He was not going to let unforgiveness invade his heart that so far has seemed to rejoice in God's purposes. And so he's not going to turn on his brothers in this moment of freedom and exact revenge. Unforgiveness indulges in the opportunity for angry revenge. Number two, that means unforgiveness perpetuates distrust and fear. Rather than living peaceably with all as much as it's up to me, I perpetuate distrust and fear. The brothers thought Joseph would hate them and pay them back, verse 15. But in verse 19, Joseph says, "Do not fear." So Joseph begins his answer with "do not fear," but then he ends his answer. Verse 21, "So do not fear." Clearly, fear is on the table. Those who are guilty are afraid because the other person has all the control, all the power. Is Joseph going to exact revenge? And Joseph takes it off the table. Stop being afraid. If Joseph was bitter and angry and unforgiving, then this would be his moment to shine. He's got them afraid. He's got them right where he wants them, and now he can pour it on. But Joseph's living by the principle, never avenge yourselves. And so he says, don't be afraid. Joseph is closing the gap. You remember he did this in physical, spatial terms earlier. When he reveals himself, he tells them, come. And then he adds, near to me. And then he hugs them. He closed that gap that is caused by guilt and shame and legitimate offense. But Joseph refuses to contribute to the brokenness of the relationship that these brothers are still getting over. They can't wrap their minds around somebody saying, I forgive you. I'm not holding it against you. I'm done with that. So who keeps bringing it up? The brothers. Did this come up in the 17 years while they've lived in Egypt? We don't know. But with Jacob out of the way, now they're afraid and they bring it up again. We don't know if the story is true. Did Jacob really say this to them? Hey, tell Joseph I said. We don't know. All we know is that they were struggling to grasp forgiveness, but there seems to be no struggle on Joseph's part to give forgiveness. And that's not to say it's because it's simple or easy. It's a work of God's grace, but it's a work of God's grace that we are called to. May we not contribute anything to broken relationships this week, even the slightest fracture of relationships. Don't let any unforgiveness invade as a foreign species your marriage this week. Don't let the first thought about your parents creep in, young people, and cause some kind of rift in the relationship. Don't allow it. 1 John 4 gives us a principle that love casts out fear. It says there is no fear in love, for perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. Well, the brothers feared because all they thought was, surely he's going to react and punish us for the evil we did to him. But Joseph, in a spirit of forgiveness, will not perpetuate fear and distrust and brokenness. As the one who has sinned against, have you ever indulged in the other person having to stew in their guilt? You don't want the reconciliation right away because you want them to think about it. Have you perpetuated conflict or tension or estrangement by failing to love in a way that assaults fear and distrust and brokenness? Are you the one saying, come near and embracing in some relational way? That is the gospel. God drawing near to us as sinners. So we cannot perpetuate the fear and brokenness in relationships with a spirit of unforgiveness. The brothers say, perhaps Joseph will hate us and pay us back. And Joseph's response is, do not be afraid of that. Don't put that out of your mind. That is untrue. Do not be afraid. That's Romans 12. As much as it rests with you, live at peace with people. Make for peace. Chase away fear and distrust. Number three, unforgiveness usurps the place of God as judge. Verse 19, Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? You might not think of this as a classic memory verse, but it should be. I've memorized a lot of verses that have done some good, but when it comes to relationships, I think they should probably have you memorize a verse like this right next to Ephesians 4, be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another. We should probably pair that with Genesis 50:19. Am I in the place of God? As a husband, am I in the place of God in the sense of relating to my wife in love? The answer is no. I'm not the judge of every wrongdoing. I'm not the one who should hear everybody's penance and keep everyone accountable for every slip up. Am I in the place of God when it comes to friendships? In the sense that I do no wrong and therefore I am the righteous judge called to make sure everyone else knows about what they've done wrong? No. As a parent, am I in the place of God? No. The question here isn't, is that role or responsibility God-given authority? Joseph's question is, am I God-like in my perfection that now I can demand from everyone else that they be perfect or else they are accountable to me? Unforgiveness usurps the place of God as judge. When you're huffing and puffing about some offense in that mental stewing, you should ask yourself the form of the question from Genesis 50. We might say it this way: who do I think I am? To expect that kind of perfection from everyone else and not myself. Who do I think I am? Am I in the place of God? How judgmental can I be? How unforgiving can I be? This has nothing to do with my view of right or wrong or my love of justice. This has everything to do with I think I am like God. Joseph says, absolutely not. I will not go down that path that puts me in the place of ultimate judgment over everyone's actions. Now, we could easily spend a long time on an aside here that says, well, wait a minute, aren't we supposed to judge righteous judgments? Aren't we supposed to be discerning? Yes and yes. And yes to every other text that tells us to be wise and to exercise authority and to hold people accountable and to challenge people with truth. Yes, but not in a spirit of superiority, a spirit of pride, a spirit of self-righteousness. And certainly in that moment when one person is guilty of an offense and you're the innocent party in that moment on that one offense, you are not in the place of God. And Joseph recognized that that is what's at the heart of unforgiveness and bitterness. It is not the weight of the offense or the sin. It is your heart's passion to be in charge. Am I in the place of God? When Christians suffered, Peter wrote to them in his first letter, chapter 4, therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to the faithful Creator while doing good. Just keep doing good, and when it's not noticed and when you suffer for it, you don't avenge yourselves. You just trust God and keep your head down. You can trust all of the sufferings to God. All of the short end of the stick that you're stuck with, you can trust that to God, who is the judge of all the earth, who always gets it right. Number 4, unforgiveness focuses excessive attention on the offense. Here's where we get into the foundation of Joseph's thinking. Verse 20. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. You meant evil against me. That is true. It is not Joseph's opinion. This is not an exaggerated rant. This is the truth. The brothers intended, they planned, they schemed, they talked about it. We have their words. They meant evil against Joseph. So I am in no way diminishing the painful consequence or the sinfulness of somebody's offense. We'll be reminded of this as we study forgiveness. We are not asking the victim to just buck up and say it's not that bad. It really is. Joseph is very clear. You meant evil against me. But the warning of the text is this. We must not focus excessively on the sin, on the offense. See it for what it is. Call it what the Bible calls it. But then you must look with an eye of faith to what God is doing with this sinful mess. You meant evil against me. Joseph's not denying it. He's not saying it's no big deal. He spent a decade of his life in the big deal of their evil. So Joseph is not dismissing it, but he's refusing the spirit of unforgiveness that says, keep focusing on how bad that was. For someone to still be telling you as a 55-year-old about how hard their childhood was is a problem. I'm not denying it was a problematic, painful childhood, but excessive focus on you meant it for evil only means less attention on God meant it for good. And you're going to have to decide. It's your choice which one you want to celebrate, which one you want to give determinative power to. Do you want to give all the power to someone's evil choice and, oh, I got to keep being reminded of they did evil and look how bad it is and nothing can be done? Or do you want to give the power to God and say, they meant it for evil, but let me tell you what God has done through that evil. Let me help affirm what the scriptures say, that God is greater than any evil that can be done. Unforgiveness focuses excessive attention on the you meant it for evil. So don't let sin and its consequences be the greatest power in your life. Don't give away your freedom to the tyranny of victimhood. Don't miss the sufficient grace that is available to you because you're so focused on the sufficient justice that should come to the offender. Don't give all of your energy to you meant evil against me. I assure you it has probably already taken enough from you. The toll may be great. The price you have paid for someone else's sin may be high. So call it what it is. They meant it for evil, and it was evil. But, the text says, there is a contrast. There is something else that we can focus on. And it's the rest of verse 20. Unforgiveness forgets the truth of God's sovereign, benevolent purposes. God meant it for good. Sovereign, benevolent purposes. Sovereign, meaning God meant it. In Hebrew, it means to plan or to think, to devise, to purpose. And perhaps the greatest definition of this Hebrew word to mean is to weave in Hebrew. So to weave a basket would mean to mean something, to intentionally make sure it's done in the way that produces the final product. Sovereign, God meant it. Benevolent, he meant it for good. Purpose, to save many. To keep his promise ultimately for the lineage of Jacob and give us the Messiah that would bless all nations of the world. But in the immediate family, just to save this family alive through the famine. God's sovereign, benevolent purpose. He meant it for good. But wait a minute. If we're saying we see sovereignty in the word God meant it, that same exact verb is used for the brothers. They meant it for evil. They schemed it for evil. They wove it together so, hey, let's put them in a pit, and if we sell them, we would actually get money, and that works into a nice plan for us. They meant it. They wove a plan that was evil. We've seen how God was weaving the story of Joseph's life for good. The path to the palace was an odd path in our estimation, but it was a weaving process. But how can it be both? They meant it and the outcome was evil. God meant it and the outcome is good, but we're not talking about two stories. It's one story. How can both be true? Evil and good being purposed. Well, Joseph's words show us the truth in the form of contrast. God's purposes and plans are greater than man's. They meant it for evil, but I'm going to offset that reality with a greater truth. God meant it for good. They still had evil intentions and they carried out an evil plan, but it was under the sovereign, benevolent purpose of God. To help us understand how it can be both, we use the word concurrence. We don't often say, I concur. You know, hey, let's go out to eat. Do you want to eat at the steakhouse? Let's go to Texas Roadhouse. And your wife says, I concur. No, it's like you're going to blow a whistle on your submarine, you know, like, okay, dive. I concur. We don't use that word, but we know what it means. It means kind of coming together or happening at the same time, agreement. That concurrence, simultaneous happenings, is the theological term for what's going on here. In theology, we get a little more precise than just two things happening at the same time. Concurrence means that even though we act according to our own desires, our own choices, our own wills, God is accomplishing His sovereign will. So even though we're making our choices and doing our thing, God is doing His thing, not apart from our choices, but in them, through them, and by them. In short, nothing or no one can ever thwart the sovereign, benevolent purposes of God. God was accomplishing His will in Joseph's life to get him into a place to save many people. He was doing that not apart from the choices of the brothers, not apart from the actions of Potiphar's wife, not apart from the forgetfulness of the men in the prison who dreamed, but in, by, and through all of those characters and their choices. You say, oh, that makes sense. And then you step back and start thinking about it, and you're like, how is that? But before you can even answer, how is that, just rest in that. That God's purpose will always be accomplished. I know it will be a struggle, but why does He use this evil, the evil intent of the brothers? Don't we all know that the story could have been Joseph was born, he was loved by his father, and the family chose to move to Egypt, and they happened to meet some friends in the palace, and Joseph grew up with one of the Pharaoh's sons and eventually became a ruler in Egypt. It could have been an all good story. Why do we have to have sin and depravity? And the answer is because we're not in heaven yet. Because we live in a sin-cursed world. But as soon as that kind of sets in, because you see it everywhere, remember this. Nothing in this sin-cursed world can thwart the goodness of God that he wants to pour out on us. Nothing can thwart his purpose that he wants to accomplish in us. The only mystery in our frail thinking is, but why all the bad? But if we're really thoughtful about that, we realize that question isn't directed to God. How come the devil's never on the hot seat for why all the bad in the world? Sin is here to stay until Jesus returns. But it is not the final say. Sinful choices and people that hurt you by their evil have not thwarted God's plan to do you good. Come back to this text. Label the sin that you experienced. They meant it for evil against me. Now the only question is, how is God meaning this for good? I may not see it, but by faith I will believe it. And you know what? We don't often think of Genesis 50:20, but we always cite Romans 8:28, which is the New Testament counterpart. That for those who love God and are called according to his purpose, he works all things together for good. How can God use the evil intent of your family members for good? I don't know. I don't know how he does that. But he says he does every time. All things. He's working together for good. They meant it for evil. God means it for good. And this is so ingrained in the world that we live in that it is actually at the heart of the gospel story itself. How can it be both sinful men did it and God did it? The gospel gives us the greatest example. As Peter preached in Acts chapter 2, he said, "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty words and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men." They meant it for evil. And Peter says as much. You crucified him. Your hands actually did it. You did it. You killed Jesus. And before we panic and think, God lost control of his own son. Some of you parents have lost your kid in the store. And if all we had is Acts 2, Peter saying, you crucified the Son of God with lawless hands, we would think God lost his only son. He lost control. He's not sovereign. And we say, that sounds foolish. And it is. Because Peter's point is, yes, that's what it looks like. You meant it for evil. But God meant the death of his son for infinite, eternal good. A good of which you have gathered to celebrate this morning. So I know it's hard to answer the question, how can it be both? But just know that there is evil that happens, and it may happen to you, but God means that for good. He will work all things for good. He worked even the death of his own son by the hands of sinners for our eternal good. It is both. They meant it for evil, God meant it for good, but one is greater than the other. And therein lies our hope for a pilgrim passage through a sin-cursed world. When you are unforgiving, you are forgetting the promise of God that he is working all things for good. Number 6, unforgiveness fails to repay evil with good. Back to Romans 12, after being told, do not repay evil for evil. Remember, don't avenge yourselves. He says, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. And then he gives this conclusion. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. If your enemy is hungry, give him something to eat. Some of you have had to do this. Maybe not with a real plate of food, But you've had to be the one to go to someone who has hurt you or some family member that has treated you unkindly, perhaps because of your Christian faith. And you have to be the one who feels like you're bringing the peace offering, though you've done nothing wrong. God says, keep doing that. Because Jesus came to you with an offer of peace when he had done nothing wrong. It was not on him to fix sin's problem. That was your problem. But he's the one that initiated the grace and the peace and the mercy. So don't be such a martyr when you have to be the one to strive for peace when you didn't do anything to disrupt the peace. Know that God's using you to share gospel hope with that person. Right there in the little context of your messy relationship. Unforgiveness fails to repay evil with good. Romans 12 moves us from that realm of theory. Let's talk about forgiveness and justice. And it takes it right into the experience of everyday life. How are you going to treat the person who treats you poorly? Joseph says in verse 21 to his brothers, I will provide for you and your little ones. He comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So be ready. Somebody will treat you wrong this week, and your response should be kindness to them. Because your feet are planted firmly on the gospel, I received kindness when I did not deserve it. I will offer kindness to those who do not deserve it. Repay evil with good. Finally, unforgiveness cripples faith in God's promises. Our text concludes with Joseph reminding his brothers that he's about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Again, like the story of Jacob, we have one verse in that faith chapter of Hebrews 12 about Joseph. And it's not by faith he endured the false accusations of Potiphar's wife. It's not by faith he endured prison. It's not by faith he trusted God to bring good out of all these adverse circumstances. Instead, it's by faith Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. It's again that forward look. God is doing something with this people. He said he would make us a great nation, and out of this nation would come a blessing that would suffice for the whole world's issues. Joseph said, you know what? God's not finished. He's going to take you out of Egypt. Take my bones with you. Just to remind everybody that God keeps his promise. Joseph lived by faith. But I think this faith in God's future promise was the result of faith presently in God's promise. It was that faith while in the prison that God is doing his good plan. That faith was never undermined by this bitterness. Bitterness that assumes God lost control and my life's a mess. Look what happened to me. In that absence of faith, that unforgiveness just flourishes because it's all we have to hang on to. A defining offense. Joseph refused to let that betrayal and hatred define his life. Instead, he would be defined by faith in a God who's doing something that he couldn't even understand. Joseph refused to let unforgiveness derail his faith in the good plan of God. So it's no surprise that at the end of his life, he's living by faith. He's breathing his last saying, God's got a plan. You need to know, is God good to keep his promise? Is God good to keep his promise to save you from your sin and give you eternal life? Generally, we're ready for that one. Is God good to bring about good in his time through the pain that right now you are pleading with him to take away? Is he good? You see, if we can live by faith in God's goodness, his faithfulness, his promise, we're not going to be crippled by bitterness and unforgiveness. That pales in comparison. The offenses just don't measure up to the faithfulness and goodness of God. Yes, they meant it for evil, but move on and get to the really good news. God meant it for good. Man, if you're here and you're still struggling with they meant it for evil and the pain is great, don't leave here today. Come and talk to me. I could point you to others that would love to support you in moving on and turning your eyes away from just the offense and to begin seeing the faithfulness and goodness of God. We cannot afford for the invasive species of unforgiveness to take over our heart and mind and crowd out a spirit-filled life. Ask God to protect you from unforgiveness this week. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for its truth. We thank you for its rebuke. We thank you for its call to forgiveness, a call to faith in the good plan that you are working in our lives. I ask that you would deal kindly as a good shepherd with those that have been hurt grievously by others, who have been sinned against and still feel those consequences or scars. Minister to them in a powerful way that would give them great victory over that hurt and pain and remembrance. And they would find great stability and hope and confidence in you, the God who is our rock and refuge. Deal patiently with all of us, please, as we tend to be self-righteous and judgmental, harder on others than we are on ourselves. Give us eyes to see, eyes tinted by the gospel, so that we will lovingly pursue reconciliation, willingly grant forgiveness, and know the peace that comes with unity and restoration. We need grace for all of this, so pour it out lavishly as you've promised to do. And we will strive to be obedient, forgiving, so that we will bring glory to you. We ask this all in the name of Jesus. Amen.